Pull up a chair for this one. I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar right here on Radio Hangar. I've got a story today that, honestly, every time I think about it, I get a little choked up. Because this one isn't just about an airplane, it's about stubbornness. The good kind. The kind where a bunch of people look at a rusted-out Hulk sitting in the California desert and say, yeah, we're gonna make her fly again. I'm talking about a Boeing B-29 Superfortress named Doc. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, to understand why Doc matters, you've got to understand what a B-29 is. This was the most complex, most expensive weapon system of the entire Second World War. More expensive than the Manhattan Project, if you can believe that. Boeing designed an airplane that could fly higher and farther than anything in the sky, pressurized for the crew, with remote-controlled gun turrets and enough range to strike the Japanese home islands from bases in the Mariana chain. Over 3,700 of them were built, and by the early 1950s, nearly all of them were scrapped, turned into pots and pans and Chevrolet bumpers. For decades, only one B-29 flew anywhere in the world. That was Fifi, maintained by the Commemorative Air Force down in Texas. Just one flying example of an airplane that changed the course of history. And the folks who kept Fifi in the air will tell you, she was tired, parts were getting harder to find, engines were getting temperamental. The aviation community knew that if something happened to Fifi, that would be it. No one would ever hear four right R-3350 radials turning in formation again. But here's where it gets interesting. Back in 1987, a man named Tony Mazzolini was working at the Naval Air Weapon Station at China Lake, California. Now, China Lake is out in the Mojave Desert, and the Navy had been using it as a test range since the 40s. Scattered across that desert were dozens of old aircraft, just sitting there targets, hulks, forgotten machines baking in the sun. Tony found a B-29 out there. She was beat up. She'd been used as a naval weapons target, had bullet holes and shrapnel damage. Sand had blasted the paint off decades ago. The tires were flat. Birds had nested in the engine nacelles. By any reasonable measure, this airplane was done. But Tony Mazzolini didn't see a Hulk. He saw a superfortress. He started doing research. Turns out this particular airframe, serial number 446972, had rolled off the Boeing assembly line in Wichita, Kansas, in 1944. She'd been assigned to the 468th Bomb Group in the Pacific, flew combat missions over Japan. After the war, she'd bounced around various military assignments before ending up at China Lake as a target drone director aircraft. They called her Doc after one of the Seven Dwarfs. See, during the war, the crew had named their planes after Snow White characters, and this one got Doc. Tony spent years trying to get permission to save her. Years. The military bureaucracy is not exactly set up to hand over surplus aircraft to enthusiastic civilians, but he kept at it, writing letters, making phone calls, showing up at offices, and in 1998. After more than a decade of persistence, he finally got approval to remove Doc from China Lake. Now here's the thing. Getting permission was the easy part. They had to figure out how to move a 70,000-pound airplane with no working landing gear out of the desert. They couldn't fly her out, obviously. She hadn't run in decades, so they put her on a series of flatbed trailers and hauled her overland to the old Boeing plant in Wichita. That journey alone took careful planning. Bridges had to be checked for weight limits. Routes had to be surveyed for clearance. It was a logistical headache before they'd even turned a single wrench on the airplane itself. She arrived in Wichita in the year 2000, and let me paint you a picture of what they were working with. The fuselage was full of holes. Not just battle damage, but corrosion, desert exposure, and the various indignities of being a target aircraft. The wings were rough. The control surfaces were shot. The engines were completely seized. Every system on that airplane, the hydraulics, the electrical, the pressurization, the turrets, all of it had to be rebuilt from scratch or fabricated new. And the team that was going to do all this, volunteers. Mostly retired Boeing workers from the Wichita plant. Men and women in their 60s and 70s who'd spent their careers building airplanes and weren't about to stop now just because somebody told them to enjoy retirement. They set up shop in a hangar and they started taking Doc apart piece by piece. The scope of the project was staggering. The B-29 has over 55,000 rivets in the wings alone. The pressurized crew compartments had to meet airworthiness standards, which meant every skin panel had to be inspected, measured for thickness, and either repaired or replaced. The forward pressurized cabin where the pilots and bombardier sat was essentially rebuilt from the ground up. And the engines, let me tell you about the engines. The Wright R-3350 is a duplex cyclone, 18 cylinders arranged in two rows of nine, producing about 2,200 horsepower each. In 1944, these engines were notorious for catching fire. They ran hot. The rear row of cylinders didn't get adequate cooling, and exhaust valves burned out with alarming regularity. During the war, engine fires were the leading cause of B-29 losses more than enemy action. So the DOC team didn't just rebuild four engines, they had to find four rebuildable cores, source parts from all over the country, and then work with modern engine shops to bring them up to a standard that would satisfy the Federal Aviation Administration. Remember, this airplane wasn't going to be a static display. The whole point was to make her fly. They found engines in warehouses, in barns, in the collections of other warbird enthusiasts. One core came from a surplus dealer in Oklahoma. Another had been sitting in a museum storage facility. Each one had to be completely torn down, every part inspected and measured against original Boeing specifications. Cylinders were honed, crankshafts were checked for cracks, magnetos were rebuilt, carburetors were overhauled, new wiring harnesses were fabricated by hand because no one makes a wiring harness for an R3350 anymore. The propeller assemblies alone were a project within a project. Each of the four Hamilton Standard propellers has four blades, and the constant speed mechanism that controls blade pitch is a precision hydraulic unit that hasn't been manufactured since the Eisenhower administration. The team tracked down overhaul specialists, found new old stock seals and bearings, and painstakingly brought each prop back to airworthy condition. Year after year, the volunteers showed up. Some of them passed away during the restoration and never got to see her fly. That's the part that gets me. These folks gave years of their lives, thousands of hours of skilled labor, and some of them knew they might not be around for the payoff. They did it anyway. Funding was a constant battle. The project survived on donations, fundraising events, and the occasional corporate sponsorship. There were times when work slowed to a crawl because there simply wasn't money to buy materials. The total cost of the restoration eventually exceeded several million dollars. Every penny came from people who believed this airplane deserved to fly. By 2015, Doc was looking like an airplane again. The wings were on, the engines were hung, the massive vertical stabilizer towered over the hangar floor. Fresh aluminum skin gleamed where desert-blasted metal had been. The interior was taking shape, with rebuilt crew stations, new oxygen systems, and modern avionics, were required by the FAA, tucked discreetly behind original-style instrument panels. The engine runs started in 2016. Now, if you've never heard a Wright R3350 come to life, I need you to imagine this. There's a whining from the starter, then a cough, then individual cylinders start firing in a ragged sequence, and then suddenly all 18 catch, and the whole nacelle shakes, and this deep, thunderous rumble rolls across the ramp. Multiply that by four, the ground vibrates under your feet. You can feel it in your chest. One of the volunteers told a reporter he cried the first time all four engines ran together. I believe it, I'd have cried too. They did taxi tests. High-speed runs down the runway at Wichita's Eisenhower National Airport, getting the feel of the controls, checking brake response, monitoring engine temperatures. Everything had to be right. There's no margin for error when you're strapping yourself into a 70-year-old bomber. And then, on July 17, 2016, Doc flew, 16 years of work, thousands of volunteers, millions of dollars. And there she was, climbing out over the Kansas prairie with four radials, singing gear tucking up into the nacelles, sunlight flashing off that polished aluminum skin. The second flyable B-29 in the world, the pilot in command for that first flight was a man who understood the weight of the moment. Every input had to be smooth, every system monitored, because this wasn't just a test flight. This was the culmination of a promise that Tony Mazzolini had made back in 1987 when he looked at a shot-up Hulk in the desert and refused to let her die. Since that first flight, Doc has been touring the airshow circuit, appearing at events across the country. She's been reunited with Fifi for formation flights, two B-29s in the air together for the first time in decades. The photographs of those formation passes are something else, two superfortresses, wingtip to wingtip against a blue American sky. Doc is based now at her own facility in Wichita, the B-29 Doc Hangar and Education Center, where visitors can walk right up to her, look up into those massive bomb bays, and see the aircraft that volunteers refuse to let become a pile of scrap in the desert. What I love about this story is that it's really about the people. Not just Tony Mazzolini, though he deserves every bit of credit for starting it. It's about the retired sheet metal workers who showed up every Tuesday and Thursday to buck rivets. The engine specialists who drove in from three states away to help with the R3350s. The families who donated $20 at a time because they believed it mattered. The pilots who volunteered to fly a 70-year-old bomber because someone had to. And because there is no greater privilege than keeping history alive in the air where it belongs. That's what restoration is really about. It's not about airplanes, it's about the people who refuse to let them go. This story draws from the Doc's Friends organization and their published restoration history, along with coverage from Warbirds News and Air and Space Forces magazine. Stop by RadioHangar.com if you want to dig deeper. I'm Tail Dragger. Go find your own airplane to save.